Yeah, Tim. You know, here's what I do. I record them. I have all I can do to get them on this memory stick. And I give them to John Watkins, and he puts them in heaven someplace, okay? Now, there's graduate students that have been accessing them. I think they're on the pharmacology website. And they are by date, and they are by... So today there will be 11-12 lecture 1, 11-12 lecture 2. And they are up to date, but Wednesday's lecture is not yet in heaven, and this week will not be there until Wednesday. I'll give John then 6 lectures to put up all at one time, okay? Okay, let me just jog your memory as to where we were ages ago in considering treatment of protozoal infections, specifically malaria, and we stopped in the middle of the stream. We were looking at one drug, chloroquine, which is one of the 4 aminoquinolones. There are several of these. We'll come back to mefloquine. That's used to treat malaria. We said it was a blood schizonticide. We looked at its mechanism of action, and we looked at the mechanism of resistance, which involved increased efflux out of the food vacuole or lysosome of the organism. So the place I would like to begin or continue is to look at the pharmacology of chloroquine. And you will see as we talk through these drugs, 3, maybe 4 or 5, all of them are going to be very lipid-soluble, they're going to be well-absorbed, they're going to distribute, including into the central nervous system, because malaria, cerebral malaria, is a significant life-threatening problem. All will undergo metabolism, and they will be eliminated as metabolites, mostly in the urine. And that sort of is the picture with chloroquine. It is rapidly, efficiently absorbed from the intestine. One gets peak levels within an hour or two. It has the ability to localize in tissue. So you find it in high concentrations in liver, in lung, in spleen, in various tissues, and they become sort of repository sites for the drug that slowly then leak it out. And chloroquine has a fairly long half-life, about 5 days. I might say that erythrocytes also accumulate the drug, and parasitized erythrocytes accumulate to even a greater extent, 20 to 50 times more than non-parasitized erythrocytes. And we saw why. The drug gets in, it gets ion trapped, and it gets localized in the lysosome. The drug is metabolized and to a variety of metabolites that are eliminated in the urine. Now, in terms of how it is used, and we'll come back, I'll pull this all together for you once we've visited the drugs. It is used to treat the acute clinical stage of the disease. It is a blood schizonticide. The adverse effects that one sees tend to be minimal. They involve GI upset. They involve some dizziness. These tend to occur at the onset of treatment. They tend to resolve with continued drug use. Chloroquine also can produce skin rash and pruritus. It can also affect vision, causing blurring of vision, and at high doses can cause a retinopathy. Now, chloroquine is one of the primary blood schizanticides. The other drug that is a blood schizanticide is a compound called quinine. Quinine is where it all started. This was the very first substance used to treat malaria. It comes from the bark of a tree, which we will visit in a second, called the cinchona tree. And it was shown that there was something in the bark of this tree that had antipyretic properties. Subsequently, that compound was isolated. It was quinine. The d-isomer of quinine is quinidine. And that's your antiarrhythmic. So this is the structure of quinine. It is a naturally produced substance by a tree. The source is the bark of the tree. Its mechanism of action is believed to be identical to that of chloroquine. So for our purposes, we will assume that the mechanism of action is identical. It is, like chloroquine, a blood schizanticide useful in treating the acute attack of malaria. Now, quinine can be given orally, or it can be given in severe cases intravenously. When it is given orally, again, it rapidly is absorbed from the intestine, achieving peak levels in the blood within 1 to 3 hours. And like chloroquine, it's extensively metabolized and eliminated by the kidneys. The use, I've indicated, is to treat the acute attack of malaria because it is a blood schizanticide. Resistance to this drug has occurred and appears more frequently in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. And resistance to quinine is believed to be the result of increased efflux similar to what we observed with chloroquine. The side effects, yes, Tim. We're going to get to that at 8:45, okay? You're just ahead of me a couple steps. I figured you needed to understand the drugs before we talked about prophylaxis and treatment.
Is chloroquine and metoclopramide, are those oral or IV?
They're oral. The side effects that you see with quinine have frequently been clumped together and referred to as cinchonism, reflecting back the source of the drug, which is the bark of the cinchona tree. And it is a dose, or these are dose-dependent side effects, and they involve the following. They involve tinnitus. They involve headache. Visual disturbances can occur. Nausea, abdominal pain. This collection of symptoms is referred to as chinchonism. It is dose-dependent. It is reversible. So one encounters these as one uses higher doses of quinine, i.e. IV quinine, but the effects are reversible effects. So here's where we are so far. We've looked at two drugs, chloroquine and quinine, that are used to treat the clinical stage of the disease that function as blood schizanticides. Now we're going to look at a third drug. It, in contrast to chloroquine, is substituted or is an 8-amino. So here's the quinoline ring system again. Good aromatic lipid-soluble ring system with this 8 substituted side chain containing an amino group. Let me just put this in context for you. Malaria, the drive to find anti-malarial drugs, has been driven extensively by war. First World War, Second World War, Vietnamese conflict, areas where malaria is endemic and resistance became a problem has really driven this. And so in the Second World War, this, all of these drugs, chloroquine, quinine being natural, primaquine, were developed. Primaquine now is a tissue schizanticide. It is a drug that works at the liver stage of the organism. It also has activity against gametocytes. So how does it work? In order for primaquine to work, it must be biologically activated. And here is the mechanism by which it is thought to work. Here's primaquine, and I did not draw out the whole side chain. So here's primaquine. And through a series of metabolic steps, primaquine gets activated or converted to this quinone-imine. And you can imagine how that might happen. The methyl group gets taken off, a hydroxyl gets introduced, and it becomes oxidized. That's irrelevant. The parent drug undergoes two or three step activation to a reactive metabolite that is going to be responsible for its mechanism of action and is going to also be responsible for its primary and unique toxic effect. So here's primaquine, here's the active metabolite of the drug, and this active metabolite now being a quinone imine can undergo redox cycling. So it can be reduced to the ion radical. It can pick up an electron from NADPH. And then reduction. Then it can give its electron to oxygen to produce superoxide, hydrogen peroxide, hydroxyl radicals, reactive forms of oxygen. And these oxidants damage, injure the exoerythrocytic stage of the disease. Now, this drug can undergo then reduction, oxidation, reduction, oxidation, reduction, oxidation, producing a flux of these reactive forms of oxygen that oxidatively damage, injure the tissue stage of the disease. Yes? Yeah, in the liver. That's correct. In the liver. If indeed this is how it works, then the question becomes, what about its clinical use and what about its pharmacology? Let me say something about resistance. Resistance to primaquin has not been a concern. Not a problem. Clinical use. This, like the other drugs, is a compound that is taken orally. It is efficiently but fairly slowly absorbed from the intestine. One gets peak levels in the range, again, of about 6 hours. It is rapidly and extensively metabolized and eliminated by the kidneys. Nothing significant in terms of its metabolism. Now, if we look at side effects, and the side effects are going to be related to the ability of this drug to oxidize, the ability of the metabolite to undergo redox cycling. And the primary, not the only, but the primary and the unique adverse effect that one sees is the production of a hemolytic anemia. That's at one extreme. More moderately, it can lead to elevated levels of methemoglobin. Now, you remember back, or you may not, but let me just jog your memory. We talked and we said that sulfonamide drugs were capable in certain individuals, i.e., those that were deficient in glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase, to produce a hemolytic anemia. And I said, just hang on, we'll talk about it when we get to primaquin, and here we are. It's not just primaquin, there are other drugs that do this, and here's what's involved. The hemolytic anemia occurs in individuals that are deficient in glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. And glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase is, in the erythrocyte, the first step in the pentose phosphate pathway that generates NADPH. And NADPH in the red blood cell, its role is to provide reducing equivalents to keep glutathione reduced, because reduced glutathione is critical in order for the cell to detoxify, eliminate oxidant substances. In normal individuals that are exposed to primaquin, those that are not deficient, more glucose, when the red blood cell is stressed, more glucose would be shunted down this pathway, producing more NADPH, keeping glutathione reduced so it can protect the red blood cell from oxidant injury. Individuals that are deficient in glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase end up having less glutathione available, because there's less NADPH to keep oxidized glutathione in its reduced form, and as a result, less ability to neutralize or detoxify reactive forms of oxygen, if you like. And as a result, these reactive forms of oxygen damage the membrane of the erythrocyte, causing lysis and the hemolytic anemia. It is not just primaquine, but primaquine is the premier drug. Now, I mentioned that this drug is the tissue schizanticide. We have, yeah.
So is that elevated methemoglobinemia as well in those?
Yes.
So both
of those happen. You will see in not just people that are glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficient, elevated levels of methemoglobin.
Okay.
Yes. It's the hemolytic anemia. If you say, what is the population? Dark-skinned males are most at risk, and the occurrence is somewhere, again, take it with a grain of salt, 5 to 10% will exhibit hemolytic anemia. Now, think of where these drugs are used. And it's not a trivial issue. Okay, one more drug, and then I'm going to try to put this all together to make sense for you in how do you use these drugs, one to prevent and secondly to treat malaria. In fact, there's two drugs. This is going to be an easy one. There is a compound called pyrimethamine. And this is the structure of pyrimethamine. And I'm going to tell you pyrimethamine functions as an inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase. The story here is going to be, it's going to be identical, only with name changes, to trimethoprim. The whole story is going to be identical to cotrimoxazole. So, how does pyrimethamine work? This is simply a diagram, again, another formulation of the fact that protozoa and falciparum specifically, like bacteria, have to synthesize folic acid from scratch. You derive your folic acid from dietary sources. This dihydrofolic acid that's produced, in order for it to be utilized, has to be reduced to tetrahydrofolic acid that then gets activated and functions as cofactor in one carbon transfer reactions. It is this step, it is specifically dihydrofolate reductase that is competitively inhibited by pyrimethamine. And if you simply flip the page, again, analogous to that of trimethoprim, here's the reaction and here's the specificity. Here's dihydrofolic acid, and it is going to be reduced to tetrahydrofolic acid. So this double bond here gets reduced down to tetrahydro. The enzyme is dihydrofolate reductase, and pyrimethamine competes for that active site with the normal substrate. It has greater affinity for parasitic or plasmodial dihydrofolate reductase than for human or mammalian dihydrofolate reductase. And if you just look at two numbers here, and here's the question, and we saw this part of the diagram with trimethoprim. What concentration of pyrimethamine is required to inhibit dihydrofolate reductase derived from Plasmodium versus a mammalian or human liver. And if you look here, there's about a 3,600 time greater sensitivity of plasmodial dihydrofolate reductase to inhibition than the mammalian enzyme, i.e., the basis for the selective toxicity. The same group that developed trimethoprim also developed this compound. Now, resistance does occur. Yes, I'm sorry. It's not, and I think it's not because it's preserved for its antibacterial activity. I've never seen it used, but we are going to see situations where antibiotics, in just a second, when we get through the drugs, where antibiotics have doxycycline, if you've ever taken doxycycline prophylactically, to go to an area that has a falciparum malaria. Resistance has increasingly become a problem, and resistance is the result of altered affinity for dihydrofolate reductase and or altered amount of dihydrofolate reductase present. Now, let me say just a little bit about the pharmacology of pyrimethamine, how it's taken. This, again, is an orally active drug. It is slowly absorbed. It localizes in tissues. It has a half-life of about 4 days. And it's extensively metabolized and eliminated by the kidneys. It is used, yes? Decreased affinity, decreased amount of dihydrofolate reductase in the organism, available enzyme. Clinically, this drug is never used alone. It is always like trimethoprim combined with a sulfa. So it is always used, or the treatment of malaria involves pyrimethamine along with some sulfa, and the sulfa that has the appropriate pharmacokinetic properties to cuddle up with pyrimethamine is a substance called sulfadoxine. And again, there's nothing unique about sulfadoxine. It is simply a sulfa that functions along with pyrimethamine to produce a synergistic antiprotozoal or antimalarial effect. The effect involves the blood stage of the organism. Pyrimethamine with or without sulfadoxine is a blood schizonticide. The combination of the two, which frequently is prescribed, but less so because of resistance today to falciparum, is called Fansidar, and you may have heard it as Fansidar. The side effects that this combination produces are the same side effects that we saw with cotrimoxazole. And that is, one has some skin rashes, One has some, let me just back off. The side effects are minimal. They involve skin rash. They involve megaloblastic anemia. And you see this? Megaloblastic anemia. Primarily in individuals that are malnourished, that have low levels of folate to begin with. Like we saw with cotrimoxazole, it is possible to reverse the megaloblastic anemia by bypassing the blockade by giving folinic acid. And since this folinic acid comes with a second name, leucovorin. So you can reverse the megaloblastic anemia in a patient that is deficient in folate by giving an activated form of folic acid that can function and restore one carbon transfer activity. Leucovorin, I wrote, it's, if you just go back to cotrimoxazole, the story is identical. There's one more drug, and then we'll put this together. And the one more drug is a number, two drugs really, two compounds, yes?
Can the bug, not the parasite, not use that folic acid?
Cannot transport it. Does not, that's a good question. Does not transport it efficiently to be able to utilize it. Yes. Ditto in bacteria, by the way. With the development of resistance to falciparum malaria, there has been a desperate need to come up with compound or compounds that would be effective. There's a class of compounds called artemisinin derivatives that have been known in Chinese herbal culture for a couple thousand years. These are compounds that are derived from a plant called the sweet wormwood plant, or Artemisia is the actual name. And it had been known for many years that Artemisia or artemisinin derivatives, compounds, were antipyretic. And in the late 80s, early 90s, the active compound was isolated and shown to have unique and very important properties in the treatment of malaria. So there are, this is artemisinin, there are derivatives of this compound that are, one, used intravenously, or let me just say, that are used parenterally. There are other derivatives of this parent compound that are orally active. That, thus the term derivatives. This drug has a unique structure, and this drug has a unique mechanism of action. And the mechanism of action involves a couple steps. It involves first the drug entering the parasite and the iron heme of the parasite cleaving this peroxide, followed by a rearrangement. The chemistry is more complex than you need to worry about and that I need to show. But the first step involves the compound entering the parasite, the iron heme then cleaving and rearranging this endoperoxide that gives rise to a carbon-centered free radical. And this carbon-centered free radical then is capable of alkylating, or if you like, forming a covalent bond with macromolecules. It is electron deficient, so it's going to be hot for electron-rich sites. And it's very chemically reactive, and so it's going to want to quickly respond and react, forming covalent bonds with macromolecules that lead to the destruction of the organism. It is the most rapidly active, safest, or has the fewest side effects of any of the current drugs that are used to treat the acute clinical attack. Artemisinin and its derivatives are blood schizanticides. Now, people that work in this area for a living, and particularly in areas where malaria is endemic, have already observed there have been reported cases of resistance to artemisinin. And so the strategy currently that is being employed by the World Health Organization and various health organizations is to combine artemisinin with another, if you like, blood schizanticide. And this combination therapy is called artemisinin combination therapy or treatment, or ACT. And it involves artemisinin derivative along with compounds that are effective against resistant falciparum, mefloquine being one example thereof. There are others. And when artemisinin combination therapy is utilized, it decreases the rate of the emergence of resistant falciparum, and the clinical outcome is better than observed with either drug individually. So the standard of care, if you like, if you can afford it, is to use combination therapy. Now, this is a diagram at the bottom here that sort of summarizes, this is now just to jog one last time what we've talked about. Here's the life cycle of malaria. Here's the mosquito injecting sporozoites that go, as we saw, first to the liver and then to the red blood cells. We saw at the tissue stage, the liver stage, was a drug called primaquine that was effective. Then the merozoites that are released from the liver enter the erythrocyte, setting up the erythrocytic stage that has the symptoms, and there are a number of drugs that are useful in suppressing the clinical symptoms of malaria. And then we also saw that primaquine also had some effects on gametocytes and the ability of gametocyte transmission back to the female Anopheles when she takes another blood meal. So these are the drugs. The question then becomes, how does one logically or rationally use these drugs? Yes? Artemisinin, yeah.
And mefloquine added together or more, is that a synergistic effect? Or is it just the additive effect?
I know not. Okay. And I don't know that it is known, okay? What is known in clinical studies is the patient response outcome is better with combination than with either alone. I can't tell you if it's synergistic or not. Yes. You know, they're so minor that they're almost not worth talking about. Yeah. This is really, you know, what happens is here's a drug that is wonderfully effective, saves lives because it's effective against resistant falciparum, non-toxic, and so it gets used fairly rapidly, rampantly. It also gets used perhaps indiscriminately. Okay, I must tell you, it is not just falciparum. It's effective against blood stages of disease. And this artemisia plant that produces, this is the source, takes about a year to grow. And it takes about a half a year to isolate the compound from the plant, okay? And now it is not possible to keep up with growing plant, harvesting, processing, and producing drug with the demand. The demand also then means the drug is probably not always wisely used, and then as a result, resistance emerges. I'm going to try to make this Gerber's, and I may not succeed, but this is always difficult because it's such a complex area to talk about. So, lest you get carried away, let's do this in very simple form. Here, we really have two issues, and this is, it breaks down very simply. You have two issues. You have two major kinds of malaria. You have falciparum, resistant, kills a lot of people, and you have vivax. The distinguishing feature of the two is vivax can relapse, if you remember. So the question is, how do you treat someone who comes down with malaria? I'll use Kenya because it's a place I'm familiar with. How do you treat the clinical symptoms, the acute attack, in an individual? Well, here's how you would treat it. If you're dealing with everything but falciparum, so all species except resistant falciparum, you would use chloroquine. And then because vivax and ovale have secondary relapsing tissue forms, you have to eliminate the organism from the liver in order to get what is called a radical cure or a complete cure. You with me? So in treating vivax, you have to treat both blood and tissue to be successful. Because falciparum does not relapse, does not have secondary tissue forms, if you effectively treat the blood stage long enough, the liver clears. And so if you're treating the patient that has resistant falciparum, there are multiple options. Here's several. One is to use quinine. It is frequently combined with another, or another alternative is to use artemisinin in combination. You say, well, how are you going to know this? Well, the World Health Organization keeps fairly accurate records of resistance and efficacy of antimalarial drugs, and you simply go and see what the pattern of resistance is, what the current drug recommendations are for the particular part of the world that one is going to. More likely, you're going to face the next dilemma or the next challenge, and you're going to know how to do it. And that is, what do you do when somebody comes to your office and says, I'm going to place X in the world where malaria is present, and you need to then provide that patient with drugs to prevent, or if you like, prevention for travelers. Again, all species except resistant falciparum, which is in a category all by itself. You can give chloroquine. So one begins chloroquine before the patient hops on a plane to depart. Typically, I think this is a week before departure, one starts chloroquine treatment. And then you will be suppressing the clinical symptoms while the individual is in the area. You don't know if he or she is infected or not, but to cover yourself and to answer that question safely and clinically, one then gives Primaquine when the individual returns to clear the liver, should there have been infection that was not detected because you were suppressing it with the chloroquine. What do you do? And this is much of South and Central America, okay? And I think major parts of Asia. What do you do if you're going to sub-Saharan Africa, and in sub-Saharan Africa, resistant falciparum occurs and is present? How do you treat, or what do you recommend for that traveler going to Kenya? Well, there's at least three options that are available, and they're probably driven much by cost and side effects. Here they are. Mefloquine is an option. It's known as Larium. And Larium has received some notoriety, maybe a bad rap. You can decide for yourself. In some patients, it causes behavioral, vivid dreams, hallucinations, nightmares, etc. Sleep disturbances. So those people that go to Kenya and use Larium have an excuse for why they can't sleep. This is a drug that's taken a week, which makes compliance a lot easier, and it's fairly expensive. A second alternative is a combination of drugs called Malarone. It's taken once a day. So again, what do? You start the patient on the drug a week before they go, and you keep the patient, we're dealing with falciparum, on these clinically suppressive drugs for 4 weeks after they leave the malarious area. By that point, any organism that is present in the liver will have been cleared into the blood and picked off. I said antibiotics are used. Doxycycline is another possibility. Doxycycline works. Doxycycline, again, if you are in, I go back to Kenya because I'm familiar, a place like Kenya that sits at the equator, you got intense sunlight, okay? This needs to be taken, the fact that this can photosensitize and cause an exaggerated sunburn response needs to be taken into account. This is a very complicated area. If indeed you are planning such a trip, the student health center is out of sight. The lady over there for immunizations and stuff is out of sight in terms of knowledge. And the other is Dr. Tom. If indeed you're sitting in Gnawbone and you have a patient come into your office, you can go to various A lot of this is patient compliance. You take this once a week. Now you got to remember every Thursday I got to take my Malarone or my Mefloquine or Larium as it's known. Or this is once a day and this is once a day. So some of it is patient compliance. Some of it is cost. If cost is a factor and you're going for a short period of time, doxy is probably a good way to go. Fairly inexpensive if you have to deal with a copay to get these drugs. I think Malarone is like $2 a tablet. It's really exceedingly expensive. Now, if you don't have insurance, let me tell you, you do doxy. But that is at least the approach that one takes to the treatment of malaria. I think this is a good spot to stop. I want to just touch one other protozoal infection, and then we're going to move to viruses in the second hour. So why don't we take our break here, and then we'll start up again in a few minutes.